And I decided to take another notch about my life and the struggles I deal with to help people realize you're not alone.
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, and you are listening to Into the Fold. The Hogg Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu, and Hogg is spelled H-O-G-G. The Hogg Foundation seeks to raise awareness of the prevalence and the influence of trauma in the lives of mental health consumers and the ways in which trauma affects behavior. A lack of understanding or appreciation of the role of trauma in shaping people's behavior can result in individuals being ill-served or even re-traumatized by those who intend to help them. People with intellectual and developmental disabilities, or IDD, are especially likely to suffer exposure to trauma while also having their trauma unacknowledged, unaddressed, or minimized. This even includes sexual assault. A recent investigation by National Public Radio found that people with IDD are sexually assaulted at a rate 7 times greater than that of the general population, and this is according to statistics that NPR received from the Department of Justice. So not only is their likelihood of victimizations far higher, but the vast majority of cases go unprosecuted. James Medors of San Antonio is an advocate for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. He is also a survivor of abuse. He's been involved with the disability rights and self-advocacy movements for many years. Our second guest, Colleen Horton, is Policy Program Officer for the Hogg Foundation and an expert on matters of policy impacting people with IDD. James and Colleen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
So my first question is for you, James. You were actually quoted in the piece that NPR posted to their website about their ongoing investigation. I was actually a little disappointed that the piece didn't allow you space for a longer quote, but I think it's only the first part of a series. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was. It was like a 8-part series of the story and stuff. It was the beginning of the series, and I share my thoughts end of the series also.
Before I go any further, I should add for our listeners that James is joining us via telephone from San Antonio. So that explains how he sounds. Unfortunately, he could not be here with us today. So have you had very many opportunities, James, to share your story so publicly?
Yes, I've been doing a lot of talks at the local Rape Crisis Center because they invited me to do trainings to the volunteers who are the first responders. And I do it like 3 times a year. And also I did my talk at get ready to do a talk in the national conference this year. At, it's Re-Event Quality. And this is the first time that group is really, really addressed about sexual assault for people with IDD. And also I spoke at the ARC of US several years ago about this issue.
Okay. And I saw a YouTube video of you going into your past experiences of abuse in more detail. And I was struck by one moment where you describe yourself as a very friendly person. It seems that people in your situation are sometimes eager to please caregivers and quick to trust, and that in some instances, this can make a person vulnerable to exploitation, or at least more vulnerable. How well does that mesh with your own experience?
Yes, but it's not each person with IDD fall into that system. People sometimes shy and quiet and distant to other people. It depends on the person's personalities. Because I'm a people person, and they also like to make new friends. But also, at the same time, other people who are real quiet and shy don't want to make friends.
Yeah, right. And so, you know, I think, you know, we have to be careful about, you know, about making any generalizations. And I'm sure that's something that even people who, you know, who work with, you know, IDD, you know, it's something that they have to be frequently reminded even themselves.
Yes, very much so.
So what would you say to those who simply can't believe that the epidemic of abuse of people with IDD could be as large as it is? Because when I first heard, when I first saw the NPR story, even I was, and I don't consider myself an idealistic person particularly, but even I was taken aback by that.
It's been not talking about. The frustrating part is, as a society and also the system, and Coney Poppy could jump in too, is that people never talk about it because, like, for example, when I was young, when I was in the high school, I was too ashamed to tell my dad and my mom and even the authority figures because I did not trust anyone. But in 2005, when I got assaulted, things changed because I learned about self-advocacy and self-determination. And with the self-advocacy skills I learned from 1989 to today, it helped me to be more empowered what I need to do to help myself and also to speak out about this issue towards the people who caused the hurt towards me. And that was the key thing, was that self-advocacy skills helped me. But when I was traumatized, when I was assaulted, I wanted to change the world right away. But a nice lady, her, who is Miss Wanda, she is the social nurse examiner. She kind of reminded me, you need to take care of yourself first before you help other people like myself. You need to take time to recover before you help everyone else to change that.
Yeah, right, right. And in doing the podcast, I've had plenty of opportunities to be reminded by different people coming from a lot of different places and spaces that you know, that self-healing and being of help to others are not mutually exclusive. And so, I mean, it's kind of been a recurring theme. So getting to that, yours is not just a story of abuse, but also of recovery, of self-advocacy, and of empowerment. And so looking back over your life, what are some key thresholds that you crossed on your way from abuse survivor toward, you know, toward becoming an outspoken advocate for people with similar experiences?
Well, for example, back in the early 90s, in 1992, in 1987, my mom, my stepmother, and my father put me in a 12-bed group home, and they thought I can do things for myself or helping others. And during that time, also in 1989, I discovered self-advocacy because the only reason I went to the meeting because I wanted to change my voting card. But instead, that group helped me to realize I have a lot of potential for myself to help others with self-advocacy issues. And never imagined myself talk about trauma until years later in 2005 from my last trauma experience that really helped me to kick another notch. What Emerald always say, when you cook something, you would kick another notch. And I decided to kick another notch about my life and the struggles I deal with to help people realize you're not alone, and also educate professional staff how to support someone who's been in trauma and to help them to grow as a self-advocate and also a person with a disability who's been traumatized. And I took some risk during that time also because in 1990, 92, I decided to move out the group home to my own place in Oklahoma. And this coming year, it's been 26 years living on my own, and also have different jobs throughout my life and my career. And now I'm happy where I'm living on my own with some friend support, with natural support, and also to help people to be inspired to help others.
Okay. And what are some reforms or changes to standard practice that you think would begin to address the problem of abuse?
One of the things I wish we could have, I don't know, we do have it in Texas, maybe have a list of people who've been Trump. You know how people have registered themselves sex offenders in the community, but instead they should add that in taking care of people with disabilities. If the caregivers or a person they thought they could trust to have like a registration list to help people know that if the staff member has been a good staff member, or to have something from the past that did something wrong and we should know about it, and to help them to know about it and to choose and hire their own staff to know that, and also hold the providers accountable to do that.
Okay.
And also educate the public about this issue, because that's important, because we need to don't think all people with disabilities are victims. They're not, because I have a brother who's also a person with a disability. He's not a person who's been in trauma before, but me, it's different, because each person have a different story, a different path, how they become a self-advocate and also a survivor. Because not each person with a disability is a victim of this crime.
Okay, so James, we're going to give Colleen a chance to jump in. But if anything else you'd like to say while we're talking to her, just feel free to jump in. Turning to you, Colleen, you work here at HOG, and so for our listeners, maybe you could start by just telling us a few things about yourself and your history of engagement on this issue.
Sure. And thank you, Ike, for taking the time to do this podcast, because it is an important issue that's not talked about very much, and quite frankly, because a lot of people aren't aware of it. But I've been at the HOG Foundation for over 8 years now, and prior to coming to the HOG Foundation, I worked at the Center for Disabilities at UT, the University of Texas, for 10 years. But more relevant to this discussion, however, is the fact that I have a 27-year-old daughter with developmental disabilities who has experienced significant trauma and the subsequent consequences of that trauma. As the NPR series is making it apparent, we have a lot of work to do to prevent the victimization of children and adults with intellectual disabilities, but also to ensure that when these traumatic events occur, that we focus on their mental health, their wellness, and their recovery. The biggest challenge is that often folks with intellectual disabilities or developmental disabilities communicate through their behavior. If we take time to really observe and look at and listen to that behavior, it tells us a lot. Unfortunately, for people with ID or IDD, we often don't take the time. And far too often, any challenging behaviors are attributed to the disability, when the disability overshadows the potential for mental health conditions. Then the impact of the trauma is missed. And what happens is we miss opportunities to provide appropriate mental health treatment and to give the individual an opportunity to work towards recovery. And this is especially true of people who are in institutions. You know, you were talking to James, you know, about some of the challenges. Well, oftentimes people don't have the verbal communication skills to tell their story.
Yeah.
And what happens is it becomes their word against a caregiver's word. And so oftentimes, even if it is reported by a family member or someone else, you know, it's rarely confirmed because it's one person's word against the other. And that person with intellectual disabilities may not always have the language skills to adequately express what has happened to them.
Okay. And so, and how did you feel about the NPR investigation and how it meshed with your own information and experience?
I think the NPR series highlighted an extremely important issue area that does need to be discussed. However, I think that this discussion needs to be much broader. Individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities experience many types of trauma. Yes, sexual abuse is one, but they also experience physical abuse, verbal abuse, emotional abuse. They are subject to institutionalization, bullying, isolation, medical trauma, and much more. So what we really need is a culture shift that addresses the mental health and wellness of individuals with IDD. In Texas, we have a state mental health system and services and programs that have a strong focus on recovery. But we never hear that word or hear that as a goal for people with IDD. For example, why is it that when you or I start exhibiting aggressive behavior or abnormal behavior, or we withdraw and we isolate ourselves from our friends and family, those friends and family members will try to get us to seek mental health assessment and mental health treatment? But if somebody with an intellectual disability, somebody with an IQ below 70, exhibits similar behaviors, instead of getting mental health treatment and support, they get behavior interventions, behavior management plans, all aimed at control and compliance, not at wellness and recovery. So one group gets support and the other one gets managed and controlled. And so we've truly missed the boat on this. And, you know, the research shows that at least 34% of individuals with IDD have a co-occurring mental illness. So we need to start paying attention to that and providing the right types of services.
Okay. And so, and I think this sort of ties into what you said. So rather than focusing just on a few malevolent actors, which, you know, any kind of sort of muckraking investigation that wants to draw in listeners kind of has to do, we can look more at the big picture, you know. So what systemic changes need to occur to begin to address this problem, in your opinion?
Okay, I think there's a number of things we can do, but we need to do a better job in addressing both the before and the after if trauma occurs. We need to provide, as James is talking about, provide individuals with intellectual disabilities real strong opportunities to develop the skills they need to protect themselves, to advocate for themselves, and to communicate when things do go wrong. And we need to give more credibility to the experiences of individuals with IDD and not just, you know, what so often happens is blow them off because of their intellectual disability or because of their, you know, communication difficulties. You know, according to the ARC of the U.S., crimes against people with disabilities are often reported as abuse and neglect, which takes away the criminal aspects of it. But also oftentimes crimes against people with ID are simply not even reported. People with intellectual disabilities might not report the crimes because of their dependence on their abuser for their basic needs. That's a huge problem. You know, if you need someone to help get you out of bed in the morning, help feed you, help get you to the bathroom, you're not going to be, if you're dependent on that person for that kind of care, it's going to be difficult to report them for crimes they commit. Also, when victims do report crimes, police and court officials may not take the allegations seriously, or worse, they may not even believe the victim.
James, were you wanting to jump in?
Yeah, I piggyback what Colleen said, because we need to educate law enforcement, because I think it's the other key thing, because they need to understand people with disabilities need to be believed. And because, like I said earlier, that when I was assaulted in high school the first time and been touched by a high-ranked board member where I used to work at Shelter Workshop, I didn't trust anyone because I was afraid no one would believe me. And, of course, I did nothing. And we need, like Colin said, we need to teach our law enforcement people and also state people, because we need to be heard and not be remain silent and do nothing. Because, like Colin said, sometimes people have behavior issues and they hold that against them instead of really, really take the time to probe them and to find out what's the problem with that person. We need to really brainstorm and do a state discussion, a national discussion about this issue, because a lot of people are afraid to speak out because they're afraid no one would believe them.
And I think what James talks about is true. You know, both in the state of Texas and nationally, there are conversations that are taking place. But people are just now beginning to realize that if an individual with intellectual disabilities is experiencing the impact of trauma or any other mental health condition, that they have a right to real mental health assessment, diagnosis, and treatment, and not simply behavior management aimed at, you know, what we talked about, compliance and control. So building awareness is the first step, but then what's important to do is to build capacity to provide the appropriate services.
Okay, so I guess this next question is for both of you. Are there tools for empowering the kind of self-advocacy that James is doing? Are there any grassroots things that are going on that, you know, that those of us who have more privilege can help to amplify?
Well, I'll start out, and then I'm sure James has some more from his experiences around the country. But Dr. Karen Harvey from the ARC Baltimore, who I think you've had on a previous podcast,
yep,
has some excellent books to help people build confidence and positive identity in people with intellectual disability. She talks about in her books how there's three primary things that folks need. They need to feel safe, not just be safe, but they need to feel safe. They need to feel like they have control or some empowerment over their own life. And they need to have meaningful relationships with some adults. And by ensuring that these three things are present, we build stronger, more empowered individuals who are better able to protect themselves and are more likely to ask for help. Another thing that is can be helpful and useful is the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, and partnered with the National Child Traumatic Stress Network a couple years ago to develop a two-day train the trainer toolkit. It's called Road to Recovery, supporting children with intellectual disabilities who have experienced trauma. And we're conducting through an organization called SAFE, we are conducting trainings across the state of Texas. But the toolkit is available online, and it provides a lot of tools to help providers and family members, you know, help children especially deal with trauma and the impact of trauma, and give them some ideas on how to, you know, protect them and build resiliency, and as the name of the training states, to help them really find a road to recovery. James, do you have some other ideas?
Yeah, I know the statewide organization, Texas Advocates, and also the local chapters talk about the basic things about what is self-advocacy and how to speak up for yourselves. But I feel like we could do more with that. And also the National Self-Advocacy Group, Self-Advocates Become Empowered, we need to talk more about trauma and how to advocate yourself more. I feel like we need to really, really kick another notch of bring more community awareness out there, have self-advocates lead the training, and also professionals be willing to partner with us when we talk about this, because I feel like that's the next move of the self-advocacy movement, I think, is we need to really take more initiative to talk about this issue, because oftentimes people are afraid to talk about it because they're afraid that people would cause judgment onto the person. Because I remember a couple of months ago in our local group, we were talking about trauma, and one of the self-advocates said, I don't want to hear it. But at the same time, I tried to explain that we need to hear it because then we could help someone else to learn how to advocate for yourself. Because that's important. It's really talk about it. It's not a bad word. It's a good word to talk about it because we are helping our peers to know what's going on and also help them to be inspired to share their story, their journeys. And it's not a bad word. We need to do more to educate self-advocates like that and also families, because then they know how to support a family member who's been traumatized, or a sibling or a grandparent, or even an uncle, to how to support someone who's been hurting that way. I think we need to somehow do a more stronger message about that, and not have to talk in a quiet room somewhere and not talk about it, but we need to talk about it.
Okay. So my last question, and if you'll indulge me, this is more an outsider's observation that you're free to disagree with if it doesn't jibe with your own experience. But I want to circle back to my I think it was my second question to James about the caregiver and person with IDD relationship. So it seems to me that a related factor might be the people who work with this population are sometimes put on a pedestal. I mean, if anything, the focus is sometimes on the extraordinary patience and endurance that it takes to care for people with IDD, whether children or adults. So in either of your opinion, does that translate to a reluctance to scrutinize caregiver behavior?
I'm not sure it's the pedestal factor that you're talking about. I think we just generally don't expect people to prey on or hurt people with disabilities, so we're not looking for it. We don't pay attention to it. We don't look for the signs.
Right.
I never thought that a teenage volunteer in a summer school program would assault my daughter, but he did. Luckily, my daughter was able to communicate what happened. So I think the bigger factor is the communication challenges. Many individuals with disabilities, you know, including children and adults, simply don't or often don't have the expressive language skills to talk about what happened in a credible way. And again, as I mentioned before, the fact that people with disabilities are so dependent on their caregivers for their basic needs can make them unwilling to report the abuse for the fear of not having someone to provide those supports for them.
Yeah.
It's like when I was young, I did not know what rape was until I saw a movie. When in my first assault, I did not know it was rape until it was rape, because I did not realize it was rape until the movie. And it's not that I pick it back with coincidence, because it's just, sometimes you think you know the person, but sometimes you don't know the person's intentions would be. Because when I was hurt by those girls at high school, I did not understand why they picked me. Why me? I thought those girls wanted to be my friends. Instead, they decided to hurt me and caused me trauma, and I felt my power was gone, and it took many years to find to admit that it was rape. And it's just important to help people realize that.
Okay. Absolutely true. And if you're interested in other shows we've done on the issue of trauma and IDD, I strongly encourage you to check out episode 35 on either iTunes or SoundCloud. Dr. Karen Harvey, whom Colleen mentioned, she lays out the basics of what it means to be trauma-informed and why this matters so much for people with IDD. James and Colleen, thank you so much for taking the time to contribute to this important conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ike. You do really great work on this.
Thank you. Very welcome. I really enjoyed myself.
And as ever, please leave a positive review for us on iTunes. Make suggestions for future content and sign up for the Into the Fold e-newsletter. Thank you for joining us.